I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We work for Obama. That's what Secret Service agents reportedly told prostitutes at a Colombian brothel while on that trip to prepare for the president's Latin American summit this past weekend. And in a scene more Animal House than West Wing, the men then spilled out into the streets in an argument with police, who were called when the agents quibbled over their bill. All of this according to ABC News. 11 agents have been suspended. At least 9 military service members working with them are also implicated. Let's get context from Ronald Kessler, former Washington Post reporter and author of In the President's Secret Service. Ronald, agents are saying the partying days of the past are over. One agent is quoted today saying the tone now is not where is the bar, but where's the gym. Some people are playing this down.
A lot of that is ridiculous. Clearly, this incident is the biggest scandal in the history of the Secret Service. It's very serious because the agents could have been blackmailed by these prostitutes into cooperating with terrorists who would love to assassinate the president, or the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, which would love to plant bugging devices and get other secrets. But the idea that agents, you know, go around partying all the time is wrong. In fact, they're so overworked and work such overtime hours that they're totally exhausted. They barely have a life at all. The problem, however, is that Secret Service management has been cutting corners, has been lax under Mark Sullivan, the current director.
So in other words, I just want to make sure we're hearing you. You're saying this is a very serious issue, but it's more of an aberration and it reflects something lax at the top of the agency?
Exactly. And we saw another example of it with the intrusion by the Salahis, the party crashers, and a third intruder, Carlos Allen, where the Secret Service uniformed officers ignored the fact that these people were not on the guest list. Now, why would they do that? Because they feel that they would not be backed by management, that management is engaged in this corner cutting. I revealed in my book, In the President's Secret Service, that Dick Cheney's daughter, Mary Cheney, would insist that her agents take her friends to restaurants. Well, they're not taxi drivers. They refused, as they should have. But she threw a tantrum and got her detail leader removed over this. So, in other words, the management, instead of backing the guys doing his job, removed him. Well, what message does that send to the people at the gates of the White House? It means, gee, if we turn away these people and it turns out they were supposed to be on the guest list, we could be in trouble. Our management will not back us. The same thing with even more serious corner cutting, where agents will sometimes let people into events under pressure from White House staffs or campaign staffs who are impatient without putting them through metal detectors. In other words, there's a line outside and the pressure is, you know, get them in, and they let them in. It's just like letting passengers into an airplane without metal detection.
Well, in the Columbia incident, agents also reportedly took prostitutes to their hotel rooms where they allegedly had the itineraries for the president's upcoming trip. You talked about potential security breaches, fears, you know, that there could have been one there. But you mentioned Mark Sullivan, the chair of the House Homeland Security Committee, Peter King, on the Today Show today, defended agency director Mark Sullivan. He said it's wrong to be prejudging him. What does Mark Sullivan have to do with this attitude that you're talking about, this cutting corners when it comes to security?
Mark Sullivan has tolerated this corner cutting. For example, when Joe Biden threw the first pitch at an Orioles game, the Secret Service did absolutely no screening with metal detectors. That means that 5 terrorists could have come in with grenades and taken him out. I mean, that is so basic. That alone should have been enough to get him fired. And yet, Salahi's come in and he's still not fired. Other corner cutting occurs, such as they don't even insist that agents maintain physical fitness or firearms proficiency.
We have to ask, you already mentioned that you feel that this happened during the Bush administration. You mentioned the Dick Cheney incident. How much of what happened in Colombia is a reflection on President Obama?
It is, in the sense that he should have fired Mark Sullivan a long time ago, and yet he still defends him. And, you know, Sullivan is a nice guy, and they schmooze, and I think Obama is impressed by the agents around him who are impressive, and he thinks this is the way the Secret Service is, and that's part of it. But, you know, if Bush were president now, you can be sure the press would be saying it's all his fault and blaming Bush. But no, Obama on Sunday said, if it turns out that these allegations in the press are true, I'll be angry. Well, it's not allegations in the press. It's his own Secret Service that issued a statement when I asked for comment to break this story, saying that misconduct occurred and that's why these agents are being withdrawn. And being angry is not exactly the way to fix an agency. It's really, you know, his life that's at stake, because agents that I've interviewed say that they believe it's a miracle there hasn't been an assassination already. I mean, you know, just think of what it means to let people into these events without screening for weapons.
That's quite a strong statement. Ronald Kessler, former Washington Post reporter who wrote in the President's Secret Service. His new book is The Secrets of the FBI. Ronald, thank you.
Thank you.
Switching gears, we know the expression race card. When someone is accused of pulling one, it means they're assigning racism where it doesn't belong. But our next guest wants to draw attention to something else in the pack he calls the violence card. We want to spend a few minutes today with Khalil Gibran Muhammad, director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library, also author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. Dr. Muhammad, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So you wrote an op-ed in the New York Times called Playing the Violence Card, and this is, of course, in the wake of the killing of an unarmed black teen, Trayvon Martin, by George Zimmerman, the white Hispanic who did have a gun. What do you mean by violence card?
Well, it means that in a moment of national outrage and protest about the all-too-familiar killing of an unarmed black person, either by a citizen or at the hands of police officers, there's a kind of response. And that response is that, well, even if the facts hold up to be the case that this is a case of a trigger-happy police officer or vigilante violence, it's really just a blip on the racial radar of America. The most common cause of the deaths of black men are the killing by another black man. And so the sense is that this is not an opportunity for national conversation, but to retreat to the space that, well, this is really black people's problem, that is violence, and they have to fix it on their own.
Well, and in the national debate that we've been hearing in the last couple of weeks, you say you've heard this violence card pulled. By whom?
George Stephanopoulos had George F. Will as a regular roundtable guest about the Trayvon Martin killing, and his immediate response is that the root fact is about 150 black men are killed every week in this country, and 94% of them are by other black men. The point is that this is an isolated incident. The real problem about violence is black men. Juan Williams had a similar response in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that effectively criticized black leadership and civil rights leadership in the person of Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, and saying, where are the marchers for the young black murder victims that occurs in this country? In fact, half of all murder victims are black, and the vast majority are killed by other black men. And so again, it was this voice of repudiating this notion that we have a racial crisis in America, when really, to the extent that there's a violence crisis, it's a black people's violence problem. Shelby Steele, a conservative author, made similar claims in a follow-up Wall Street Journal piece that was after Juan Williams's.
Well, so you're not disputing any of these statistics that these people are pointing to. You're saying that that when they point to these statistics, and when we hear the phrase black-on-black crime, it's saying, don't look here at Trayvon Martin. It's saying, look over there at that.
Well, it's a way of taking the criticism and the frustration and in some cases the outrage of a dead black person, and saying, well, if you really do care about dead black people, then why are you focused on George Zimmerman? Or even in the case of, and we haven't heard this because the Tulsa cases are so explicitly egregious, and so you don't hear people sort of pulling the violence card in that instance. But in effect, it's saying if the issue is dead black men, then your primary focus should be on all of the black men who die at the hands of other black men. I mean, that's the violence card. But aside from pointing to that reality, which is a grave reality, it contributes to, one, the pathologization of black people as exceptional, when in fact intraracial murder is true of every single community everywhere in the world. Most people die at the hands of people who are categorized as like them, and indeed the vast majority of people die at the hands of people who they know.
Well, let's pick up on that. You mentioned Tulsa. That's, of course, two suspects who are alleged to have literally gone and looked for black people to shoot and kill. There was also the case in Mississippi, a young white man who was charged with a hate crime for looking for a black person to kill, and he did. But this idea of saying, look away from those crimes and instead look at black-on-black crime, Author Edward Wyckoff Williams wrote recently in the online magazine The Root, "Don't White People Kill Each Other Too?" He points out 84% of white people who are murdered by other white people. And so if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying it's making it something that just blacks do when you point to black-on-black crime, but it also makes it, what, their problem, not society's?
That's correct. There is no language or discourse about white-on-white violence. So that move in and of itself stigmatizes black people. It associates blackness with violence and or criminality, rather than it being a social problem of homicide, which exists in all communities. Really, it boils down to a numbers game. Simply because there are disproportionately higher rates of murder in black people, all of a sudden it is a racial reflection, evidence of black people's pathologies, as opposed to in white America, where it's a much larger pool of people, and yet a huge sample of dead bodies that no one ever claims is evidence of white-on-white violence. The other part of that is, of course, that by labeling it a racial trait or racial phenomenon, it lets the larger society off the hook as having any responsibility for actually intervening, and becomes a kind of self-reinforcing narrative that black people really don't care about fixing their own problems. The only time that they get worked up is to blame white people in the case of a white person killing a black person.
And you say this is all as opposed to other times in history when there were alarming statistics and society did do something about it. It had to do with white-on-white crimes in the crime waves of the 1890s and 1930s.
Sure. So this is a period of the Progressive Era when a million immigrants arrived to the United States between 1900 and 1914 and oftentimes were confined and limited to very impoverished inner-city communities. Those communities had the similar earmarkings of what segregated, impoverished communities look like today. And consequently, there were also high rates of youth violence, so much so that the juvenile court system, the very infrastructure of how we deal with young people today, was established in Chicago in 1899, and Jane Addams was one of the foremost social workers and community activists of that period. In a nutshell, she marshaled public and private resources to address the problem. She helped to pursue child welfare labor laws. She helped to pursue political reforms for communities where corrupt police officers would allow drug dealing. In other words, she said that the problem of violence in these communities is not for them to fix alone.
You write that under Chicago's Jane Addams, the violent immigrant ghettos were filled with social workers, police reformers, exactly what her contemporary Harvard economist William Ripley wanted. He said, these new immigrants are ignorant with a disposition to violence. But then he added, that was precisely the argument for helping them, because the health of the nation depends on their vitality. But Dr. Mohammed, pick up there. You know, what do you say to people who ask, isn't the government doing the same thing today with social workers, welfare, food stamps, doing for poor blacks what Jane Addams did in Chicago for poor immigrants?
I would say too little, too late. The irony is that Hull House, her premier social work agency, segregated African Americans within that space. They were limited to a few hours on a couple of days of the week, emblematic of social work in that era, that effectively redlined African Americans out of that. The very foundation that helped immigrants to become Americans left African Americans out, not just out of social work, but they were redlined out of the New Deal, and they were redlined out of suburbanization that happened in the period of the 1940s through the 1960s. By the time we get to the war on poverty, it lasts roughly 8 years, and then we get the war on drugs. In other words, we've not had a recent period, that is, over the last 50 years, where there weren't competing debates about the origins of black poverty and crime, in spite of what you describe as an infrastructure. I work with many of those practitioners, and the number one complaint that those social workers will tell you is that they are under-resourced. They are constantly fighting for the dollars. But let me tell you one other thing. Police officers were made accountable in the Progressive Era to the politics of compassion that was necessary to destigmatize and give those kids a second chance. Cops became frontline social workers in ways that is completely opposite to the way the policing functions today.
I'm sure there are some police who would argue that, but it's easy to see how police in that era probably immigrants themselves and did not see the community they were working with as the other and all the complications that come from that. But I just want to swing back to, you know, where we started, which is, as you say, conservative commentators pulling what you call the violence card. In other words, pointing to statistics about black violence against other blacks to sort of maybe swing the attention away from something like the Trayvon Martin killing and absolve society from feeling they have to do anything about it. Isn't there a possibility, given some of the statistics today, that some of these commentators, Juan Williams, for instance, come to mind, are genuinely concerned about this, are not trying to take attention away from one thing, but trying to draw attention to another?
Yes, absolutely. I wouldn't attempt to get inside the mind and to somehow tease out motivation. What I would say is that the argument ultimately upholds the political and economic status quo and says effectively that the problems that face black Americans, whether they're violence or whether they're poverty, are cultural problems. And until black people get their stuff together, until they literally pull their pants up, their problems won't change. And that simply is not sufficient to the challenge that should be met. It did not attend to the problem of the immigrants of an earlier period. It did not attend to the problems of working class white Americans in the 1930s. Indeed, no group of white Americans since the period after the Civil War have been asked to solve similar social problems as a cultural response. Crime statistics have been part of the stigmatization of blackness and crime. The statistics were intended in the use of immigrants to point out their class inequality, their victimization in an industrializing economy that benefited the elite at the expense of the working poor. And in the case of African Americans, the crime statistics were used as a simple measure of their inferiority and really proof, as Southerners were very interested in arguing, that black people needed to be segregated.
We're talking to Khalil Gibran Muhammad, quite thought-provoking. And Dr. Muhammad, I can't let you go without mentioning a couple of things because your name is going to be very familiar. Your father was the Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer for the New York Times, Oshir Muhammad. Your great-grandfather was Elijah Muhammad, one of the leaders of the Nation of Islam, who early on called for a separate nation for blacks, famously, you know, saying blacks should move away from the blue-eyed devils. But then he was said to moderate that tone and focus on self-help among blacks. I just wonder, I mean, talk about you can't read somebody's mind, but would your great-grandfather, as you seem to be saying, be calling for an infusion into the communities, the same kind of Jane Addams did? Or would he be saying, we have to go it alone, you know, maybe even in a funny way, agreeing with George Will, saying this is the black community has to take care of this problem?
My great-grandfather, if he were trapped in 1975 and applying that mindset to 2012, I think that he would see George Zimmerman's behavior as Exhibit A in a long line of violent acts committed by non-blacks towards blacks and evidence that black people can't live among whites with any safety and that they have to retreat to their own communities and do for themselves.
Having heard everything you've said, if your assessment of all this is true,
sure.
One of the saddest things is that in delaying addressing the problems of the ghettoized African Americans post-Civil War, mm-hmm. one of the other effects is that you have a lot of white Americans who are tired of hearing about it because they feel they keep hearing about it and hearing about it, and then, as you've pointed out, nothing was done, as it was with the immigrant communities. So there's almost a fatigue about it.
That's exactly right. And when you talk about racial fatigue, there was racial fatigue in 1914 amongst one of the most liberal social workers of that time period saying, we can't do anything for these people. Never mind the fact that Plessy versus Ferguson had just been passed, you know, 20 years before, and it was the age of segregation. So what you describe in terms of the pessimistic reaction to what I've described was pessimistic 100 years ago, but we've got to get past the pessimism. We've got to buck up and say, we've got to get this right, because every generation has grown tired of having to deal with the race problem.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad is the director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library, also author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. Dr. Muhammad, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me on.
He says he should be acquitted, but he also says he would do it all over again. Anders Breivik, the man accused of massacring 77 people in Norway last July, made those and other statements during his trial today, reading from a 13-page statement he called his rampage, which included killing 69 mostly young people at a Labour Party youth camp, the most spectacular attack by a nationalist militant since World War II. The trial has been stunning so far, bringing back horrific memories for Norwegians, and also revealing that Breivik called police and tried to give himself up before killing at least 41 people. The BBC's Lars Beveger has been in the courtroom. He's come out to speak with us. Lars, what do you make of Breivik's statements? What's the case that he's making that he would do it again, but he shouldn't be guilty?
Well, what he argues is that he is more or less at war against a system which he sees as threatening the very existence of Norway and also the rest of Western Europe. He believes multiculturalism and Islam are both things that are threatening to undermine the Norwegian national identity, and this he feels is enough to commit these atrocities that he has admitted to committing. Now, he told the court today that he was not regretting anything. His acts were based on goodness, not evil. And of course, these are all very, very difficult things to understand, not least for the people, many of the victims and their families who are in the courtroom listening to him every day.
Well, and it also just brings into focus this kind of question. Is somebody who feels this hatred and this militancy, are they insane? I mean, Norway, we know, doesn't have the death penalty, and it has had psychiatric examinations of Breivik. One found him legally insane. Another found him sane. It's up to the judges in the trial to decide whether to send him to prison or psychiatric care. So do you have a sense of how they're parsing these statements?
Well, it's hard to know, but the big question here is whether he's criminally accountable for what he did, when he did it, and whether he is so today. The court will, as you said, take everything into consideration, both the reports and all the evidence presented, his and the victims.
We understand Breivik's been comparing his actions to others in history. For instance, he compared his attacks to the U.S. Bombing of Japan. He said they did it for something good, to prevent further war, you know, implying that he was doing the same thing.
He has drawn big historical lines in his evidence this morning. He was in fact at one stage stopped short by the judge, who said, you need to concentrate on what has happened in Norway here. This is what you're tried for. He's taking in a world view. It's not just confined to Norway, this case, in his mind. He was using countries like Japan and China as examples of countries he says has not allowed multiculturalism to take root, and it is quite unfathomable for anyone else really to get their head around how one person can justify such horrific acts in such a cold and calculated manner, which he has been doing in the courts these days.
Well, what's been the reaction on the part of victims? We're reading, you know, Norway's a small country. Everyone knows someone or seems to who was either killed or affected by this after he's accused of not only sending off a bomb in Oslo's government district on July 22nd, which killed 8 people, but then going to this island and killing 69 more. Well, how is this affecting people?
Well, that is so true. It's a very small country. It's 5 million people. And yesterday I rode a taxi with a taxi driver, said he knew 2 people who died on Utøya. And what's more, he once gave Breivik a lift in his car. It affects everyone here. And the general mood, if you can generalize about a thing like this, is that people want the justice to be done, and they are aware that they will have to sit through these 10 weeks of trial. But at the end of it, they're looking forward to the trial being over, for him to get his verdict, and for him to go away, basically, so this country can carry on and people in it can carry on with their lives.
The BBC's Lars Beveger speaking to us from Oslo. Lars, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Water main break in Sleepy Hollow. Run water on tap until clear. That bulletin came from the Tarrytown Sleepy Hollow Patch in New York, Patch being the hyperlocal news websites, more than 800 of them, together attracting about 10 million visitors, lots of eyeballs, but so far not a lot of money. Patch's parent company, AOL, reportedly poured $140 million into the venture last year, but the site's only made $20 million in revenue. Investors aren't happy, media watchers are wondering if the promise of hyperlocal news is viable, and the people who helped launch and loved the sites are worried. Sean Roach was one of a dozen journalists hired back in 2009 when AOL first bought Patch. Sean ran the Tarrytown Sleepy Hollow Patch for 2 years. He joins us from New York. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
And first of all, we love if people are saying Sleepy Hollow, wait a minute. Yep, it's a part of upstate New York, legend of Sleepy Hollow. It's just a beautiful area outside of Manhattan. What was your job first like when you came to Tarrytown and Sleepy Hollow? What were you supposed to do?
When I came on, I was bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, dropped into Tarrytown and Sleepy Hollow. Didn't know too much about the community, but, I got caught up really quick. I came into this community, there were two monthly papers, there was no competitive web presence, there was no way for people to get the information that they needed on a daily basis. And when, you start posting things about water main breaks, a fire that happened the night before, or why the store's closed because there was a robbery, people got really interested really quick, and it's information that they didn't think they wanted, maybe, or they didn't know was there, and as soon as it was available and at their fingertips, people really jumped on ship.
Some of the editors, you were the editor of the Patch site, and some editors elsewhere, they might focus just on sports, others focused on politics, but you kind of, threw a wide net. How successful were you in getting people in the town to look at their Patch?
I think I was very successful. I know that I had one of the highest unique views, at least in the Hudson Valley region, for Patch sites. Part of that was, like you said, just covering a wide swath of the community. I really focused on hard news and crime, stuff that wasn't really covered. Sports was adequately covered by some of the monthly papers, but, I kept tabs on that on a day-to-day basis. And so it was really just bringing all the great parts of a daily paper online, and people really jumped on that, and it showed in the response that I received, and the people that would stop me on the street and say, like, "Oh, I read the Patch now, and it's really important that I read it every morning." Or
very
like
cool,
that.
And a lot of work. How much were you working?
A lot. It was a 7-day-a-week job for sure, more than 60 hours a week in Tarrytown and Sleepy Hollow. It's kind of convenient. There's a fire alarm that goes off like a huge whistle,
right, I know
that the whole town can hear if something's happening. So I lived in town, and if something went off at 3 a.m, I'd turn on my police scanner and figure out where the fire was. And so it wasn't by any means set hours. You would get up whenever you had to get up and report whatever was happening at any time.
Well, not only that, AOL required that, the owners required that the editors, the Patch editors like yourself, connected to the local community through charities and volunteering. And you joined an ambulance corps?
Yeah. It was a requirement at first. I think it was kind of let up later on as it became unsustainable for some people to do. But I did join the local ambulance corps. It's something I do. I volunteer as an EMT in both Tarrytown and Sleepy Hollow. And it was a bit of a conflict of interest at first. And it was difficult to kind of separate the journalist from the EMT. But I did an adequate job.
Well, I have to say, it really warmed our hearts to see that you could be called as an ambulance volunteer. You might be called out to an emergency. But you were so devoted to keeping a firewall between your volunteering and your journalism that you would wait for someone else to drop a dime on that emergency till you could report on it.
Yeah, it was kind of ridiculous at times because I'd be helping this woman out, like maybe just rampage through town on a drunk driving spree. But I would just have to wait till the cops kind of said, "Guess what happened last night?"
And right.
Like, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was there. I was in the ambulance. Yeah. Anyway, so you're a devoted journalist. You are a devoted manager of this website. You've got people in town saying, "Hey, this is great," and yet not a lot of advertising.
Yeah, that was always a difficult thing. I was kept separate from the advertising side of things, but you know, I could see from a day-to-day basis that there wasn't a lot of advertising on my site, and a lot of people would read it, but the advertising just didn't come with it. I know a few people that advertised with us, people that I made friends with, and I talked to them about whether they thought they were getting their money's worth, and they didn't really renew their ads. So,
why? What was the problem? People loved the site, but what was it? The recession? What was it?
I'm not sure totally, but I think the recession had a lot to do with it. I think it also has to do with lots of local businesses are used to advertising in newspapers. And, the monthly papers that are in Tarrytown and Sleepy Hollow go to every single residence, whereas maybe some of the residents weren't getting online looking at the patch. So I think there's a learning curve that's going on with businesses as they slowly bring their advertising online.
Well, and as the learning curve goes on and they try to figure out why there isn't more revenue from this thing that seems to be popular, patch, things start to change. You start getting handed down new mandates. There was a push from corporate, I guess you could say, to, well, there was one initiative to cater to moms. You know, how did you react to this?
Well, it's kind of interesting to me because I've also talked to a few other people who worked at different local startups, Main Street Connect being one. And there is this kind of obsession with the mom audience for some reason. People think that because they're online news that there's just all these moms sitting around waiting to read online news. But it's not really what I found. I think a lot of people find time to read news, whether they're mothers or fathers or just people in the community. It didn't really come off as successfully as I think some people on the back end wanted it to.
At a certain point, there was another change. AOL bought the Huffington Post. Arianna Huffington was put in charge of all AOL's news sites. What was the effect of that?
The call went out almost immediately to gather bloggers, and it still goes to this day. I volunteer in the community, and I do a lot of environmental work, and I still get asked to blog for Patch, even though I'm not working there anymore. So that's one of the big things. And then aggregation was also kind of stepped up after that.
Aggregation meaning gathering things from all different patch sites and putting them on one, which takes away from some of the local flavor.
I think it does. That's my opinion. I think, gathering news stories from, if I'm in Tarrytown, Sleepy Hollow, gathering news stories from Larchmont or White Plains, it just doesn't have the same flavor as, a truly local site or newspaper would have.
Well, as you mentioned, you're not there anymore. You left.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because of burnout. It's just unbelievable amount of work. But you still have hope for Patch. What do you think has to happen? I mean, what is missing?
It's difficult to say. There's this balancing act going on between this really hard news approach to Patch sites and then this really friendly kind of all-inclusive community, moms, club, coffee culture. But I think just solid reporting and a lot of work is what usually is involved in making a site successful, whether it's Patch or something like the West Seattle Blog or the Oakland Local. It's just a lot of hard work, a lot of feet on the ground, and a lot of making connections.
Sean Roach, who used to run the Tarrytown Sleepy Hollow Patch, and he wrote about his experience at the Patch in the Columbia Journalism Review. Sean, thank you.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
The 3D version of James Cameron's 1997 movie Titanic has pulled in $44 million since its release nearly 2 weeks ago. And it's bringing back memories for Titanic history buff Edward Kamuda. He runs the Titanic Historical Society out of the back of a stationery store in a quiet neighborhood in Springfield, Massachusetts. His interest was sparked decades ago when, as a boy, he read a short story called A Great Ship Goes Down.
It just seemed to grow on me. I wanted to do more research on it.
Then Edward Kamuda saw the 1952 film Titanic at the movie theater his family ran. And 2 years later, his father booked the movie A Night to Remember.
What did you see?
Iceberg, get ahead, sir!
The teenaged Edward Kamuda got his hands on a press packet for that film and told Here and Now's Lynn Menegon how what was inside that folder changed his life and ended up preserving some history.
Inside the folder were about 85 names and addresses of survivors that were still alive. It was done in the hopes that if you're a theater manager and there was one person living nearby who was a survivor, you might invite them as your guest. And of course, you'd notify the press and you get a lot of publicity. I spent the rest of the summer writing to them and trying to find out how they came to be on the ship, how they got off the ship, and what's happened to them after that. And all of them replied to me. And so everybody from Frederick Fleet, who sighted the iceberg, to third-class passengers, all responded, and it was quite thrilling.
How remarkable. How old were you at the time?
I was about 14 years old at the time, and we started the society in 1963 when I saw a picture of a survivor in the New York Times, and I wrote him a letter. And because he had no immediate family, all of his materials were thrown on the city dump. And I was aghast at that. I said, my gosh, they're throwing away history. And so in my next letter to the survivors, I said, we're going to form an organization that's going to preserve all of this.
Do you have any of those original letters from, say, the man who saw the iceberg, Frederick Fleet?
Yes, I still have them. In fact, he sent me a sketch at my request of what the iceberg first looked like. and then how it towered above the ship. And I remember one Christmas I didn't get a card from him, and I wondered, I wonder what's wrong. And someone called me up, and they said, I'm in New York. Did you see the New York Times today? And I said, no, I didn't. He said, poor old Fred is dead. I said, oh, my gosh, you're kidding. He said, no. And I said, what did he die of? And he said, he hung himself. So I went down to our post office box here and opened up the door, and there was only one letter there. And I recognized the handwriting, and it was from Fred Fleet. And he said, please don't write to me anymore until I get a new address. He says, my wife has passed away, and we were living with my brother-in-law, and the two of us do not get along. And so basically his brother-in-law threw him out. And so he said, as soon as I find a place to live agreeable to my meager pension, I will let you know. Apparently he couldn't find anything, and he ended his life. And the press, of course, put this off as the tragedy of the Titanic was on his mind so much that it drove him to die. No, it did not. No, Fred lived on and hardly spoke of the Titanic unless somebody come up and ask him about it, or in my case, wrote a letter to him.
Well, it sounds like not a lot of people wrote to these survivors, mm-hmm. and you brought something out in them that maybe, you know, would have been lost to history.
That's quite true. A lot of them kept it very quiet. They didn't want to talk about it. It was a horrible, horrible experience. I remember Frank Goldsmith, who was 7 or 8 years old at the time, and he corresponded with me in his later years, and he said every time he'd go to a ball game and somebody would hit a home run, he said that roar from the crowd reminded him so vividly of that night and the people screaming in the water, and it was very hard for him to take.
What other things did you learn from just corresponding with survivors?
I've got letters from Gershom Cohen. They call him Gus the Cat. And Gus certainly had 9 lives. But in this case, he was coming to America. He was a 17-year-old teenager to find work because things were bad in England. And he booked passage on the Adriatic. But he was transferred to the Titanic in third class. And he had just gotten a new pair of gloves from his mother just before he left. And the night that they hit the iceberg, he got out on deck and most of the boats were gone. And he saw this one that was being lowered. So he said, I did something I would never do. And he crawled out on the davits that were letting the boats down. And he slid down the ropes. And he says, thank God for the gloves. Otherwise, my skin would have been really torn apart going down those ropes. And he got into a lifeboat and he was saved. And he went back to England and to fight during the war, and he was on sentry duty one night, and he was shot through the head by the enemy, and he lost the sight of his left eye, but he says, I survived. And years later, he went off the wrong end of a train and hit his head on the rails below, and he survived that. He opened up a haberdashery shop in London. And one customer was so grateful at the deal he got from me. He said, I'm going to treat you to lunch, Gus. And Gus never passed up a free lunch. So he locked his shop. They were walking down the street, and then he heard a familiar sound of a buzz bomb coming overhead. And guess whose store was blown to bits? Gus Cohen, and the cat lived on.
No way. He really was a cat with 9 lives.
He was, yes. He died of old age. So he's one of my favorite survivors.
You know, I was struck by something I saw when I came in the room. There's an original newspaper,
yes,
framed from 1912. Could I ask you to read the headline?
Well, the headline says, Titanic passengers all saved. And the sub-headline says, iceberg did not sink the giant liner. There was a ship that was being towed to Halifax. And this ship that was doing the towing radioed to the other ships, are all Titanic passengers saved? Well, the reporter heard this, and then he took it to mean that Titanic passengers were saved. And I guess he didn't listen to the whole message, and so that's how that came about.
Come on. No, Jack, I couldn't possibly, Jack.
Watch closely.
That's disgusting.
Now, I understand you were a consultant to the James Cameron movie from a few years back.
And as a thank you, he invited us to come down and have a cameo in the movie.
Describe what the scene was.
It's just after Jack teaches Rose how to spit like a man, and they meet up with Molly Brown, and she invites him to her cabin to get him some proper clothes to wear for the big dinner, and we come walking by.
Son, do you have the slightest comprehension what you're doing?
Not really.
Well, you're about to go into the snake pit.
We did this scene 8 times because Kathy Bates kept on cracking jokes and breaking everybody up. It was quite thrilling, having worked in my father's movie theater till age 16 for so many years, and now here I was on the big screen.
Kind of comes full circle.
Yes, it finally did, yes.